Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
And we're live. How you doing, Micah?
I'm great, Nick. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for joining us today on the Ethics Experts.
Thanks. Now, I was wondering, is Nick short for Nicholas or is it long for
Yeah, it's actually long for you're like the first person I've ever met that actually recognized that I have a reverse nickname. So well done.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Thank you for asking. Thank you for asking.
You're welcome.
So, Micah, you wrote this book that I read a couple of weeks ago. It is one of my favorites of all time. And the book is called Ignore Your Customers and They'll Go Away. And I read a lot. This has made it to the top of my personal bookcase. And I'm just so thrilled to have you on the Ethics Experts today.
Well, that's really an honor because I've followed your stuff and you're a big reader. So I really appreciate that.
Yeah, I am I'm a credible source here. I'm a credible critic. And my opinion should mean a lot to anybody who's listening to it.
Wow. Well, you made my day. And listeners, let's just say thanks. Well, I'll say thanks to at this point.
You know, only my mom calls me that. So you can just call Nick if you want.
All right. A little gallo humor.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. So let's just jump in. I'd love to hear about what prompted you to write this book, how you got into the game that you're in, and you know how you were able to pour so much passion into this book and rise above the din of books that are kind of carbon copies of each other.
Well, thanks again. So the book, Ignore Your Customers and They'll Go Away, is my latest book, and it's actually by far my favorite because I really got in deeper into the issues of improving your own customer service experience. And I shared whatever I could from my own experience. I am considered a customer service turnaround expert, which means I'll come into your company and we'll work together to transform your relationship with your customer. So that's what I do every day. And it's the best job in the world. It includes a little mystery shopping. And this is where my friends, especially my lady friends, get very annoyed with me because I do actually go to 5-star spas in incredible resorts. And I am obligated to get a pedicure and a manicure and a massage, all for research purposes. And as you'll read in the book, I also sometimes get a facial, and that's the only part that gets tricky because, you know, they'll put the cucumbers over my eyes, or more commonly now, you know, they'll put the mask over my eyes. And at that point, it's a little hard to take notes and it's a little hard to see what's going on around me.
Well, it's a tough job that you got, Micah, obviously, but someone's got to do it and you just do it so well.
I do draw the line after seeing the 40-year-old virgin. I do draw the line at waxing. Even I don't want to be the guy out there yelling Kelly Clarkson for any price.
Fair enough. Yeah, you have to know where your own limits are, yes. No matter what you're doing. So I'm glad you found
it. Or shall we just say no one's gotten that price yet for me? I haven't reached that price.
At some price, you will scream Kelly Clarkson, let's be honest here.
Could be.
So how did you get into this game? How did you get into this this customer service turnaround game, and what was it that, you know, showed you that you have such a penchant and gift for it?
There's two answers to that question, and they're both true. Let's say the more colorful answer is that I've just always been very particular. So I actually found a note that my parents had saved from when I went to summer camp. And good customer service, the counselors at the end of the year, apparently, the end of the season, would write a note to their customers, who, if you think about it, are the parents, right? So they write this note, and it's trying very hard to be positive, but it says, we will miss the rigorous company of being with Micah. There won't be anyone left to tell us that our sloppy joes don't pair very well with the orange juice, that the whistle at the waterfront is out of tune, and so forth. So we're happy to return him to your care, Mr. and Mrs. Solomon, until the next season.
This is real. This is amazing.
So that's the one true story. So as my wife says, I finally found a job where I get paid to complain. And So that's the one side. The other side is that I had a successful manufacturing company. I know this is going to sound very quaint. Some of you guys have only seen these on the History Channel, but we manufactured CDs and DVDs for musicians and independent filmmakers. And we were very successful, and it wasn't like our discs were any rounder than anyone else's. They weren't 361 degrees round. They were just as round and just as sparkly, and they played just as well. But we were always able to stay out of the commodity zone where you only can charge, you know, a bare minimum because of our exceptional customer service and our customer experience. Can you stand here a little more with this answer?
No, I love this actually, because this is like the best picture, I think, of what sort of proper customer service can do, particular, like to your point, you were in a very commoditized business. Like you said, like
it's really important. Yeah. It's a really important way to rise above being a commodity. I mean, there are other ways you can do it. Like Uber and Lyft have done it with the convenience, right? With the convenience. But not everyone can do that. You know, if you think you're going to be competing with Amazon, it's like competing with a moon launch, right? But we can always do better on the human side of it. And it is really one of the most powerful sources of marketing and staying out of that deadly commodity zone that's out there.
It sounded like that was your sort of competitive advantage when you were in the CD. I mean, what would you call it? The CD game, right? But do you feel like that was an intentional thing, or do you feel like it sort of naturally sprung out of who you are as the, you know, how did they call it? The rigorous company you tend to, to keep.
Well, I think it's both. I mean, I think I realized that we could never be the lowest priced player, and so we had to do something else. But when I've talked with my employees from that era, they said I always was persnickety in ways that they thought just didn't matter. And they learned from working with me that they actually did matter to the customer.
So what are some of those things? Because this is always where this is a game of inches, I think. And those things at the margin that some people call persnickety, which is just a nice way to say obnoxious to your face, right?
Like not that nice way. Yes.
Okay. but like, from somebody who doesn't understand that these things actually do matter, these things that they think don't matter are actually what separate you from everyone else. So just talk about what some of those sort of those things were in your specific business.
Well, that's a really good point. We can talk about it in anyone's business. So you can answer the phone in four rings, or you can answer the phone in three rings. Well, why would you bother answering it in three rings? Because studies have shown, and these studies were done on behalf of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company, but you're getting it here for free, or as I prefer, for $20 if you read my book. These studies say that after three rings, people are nervous. They don't think that you're going to answer. They don't think you're going to answer with a human being, and so forth. So the difference between three and four rings really matters. Why should you meet everyone on every channel they want to reach you on? Like, damn it, now I have to have Instagram. Well, if that's where your customer wants to meet you, I would recommend it, because it is somewhere where you can differentiate yourself.
So that, I want to talk about that first piece, because I think that's a picture of a larger issue. And what you're doing is you're kind of cutting them off before they can open that sort of door of like psychological anxiety in their mind. But once that's open, now that energy is kind of in the mix, in the experience, no matter how great the experience is going to be once you actually start engaging with them, right?
Well, they hopefully had a little less anxiety because you answered quickly, right?
Yeah, but I'm saying even if you wait till four or five rings, which is still relatively quick, Okay. Now that energy is in the conversation, or they've opened the door to that in their mind. And what you're doing by answering it at three rings is you're not even giving them the opportunity to even have those thoughts before that engagement can be tainted by those thoughts.
Exactly. Exactly. I think that's correct.
So it's just a really important point, but why do you think most organizations don't understand that, you know, what we're talking about is a culture, and we're talking about a branding, right? Like a brand is really just the sum of all of a brand is your reputation, and your reputation is just the sum of all the actions of all the people who administer your product or your service to the marketplace. Why do you think so many organizations have such a hard time understanding the value of this sort of game of inches or this battle at the margin of differentiation?
A lot of times people call me and they're already doing pretty well as far as service and they just want to become spectacular. But there are these other companies that just have no idea how valuable it is. And I think those are the ones you're talking about. And I think it's because they've found another way to maybe not thrive, but do okay by selling, because maybe they have a really good location, right? I mean, that's a secret of being the gas station, right? Is to be on the right corner. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they have a technology that right now is unique, but may not be for long. So they're kind of resting on their laurels there and not realizing that while they have whatever the advantage is, why not use that to make yourself irreplaceable to your customer? Because then when the gas station opens across the way, people will still go. I mean, there's some studies, but people will still go an extra block or two to come to you because they really like working with you.
Yeah, I read a story somewhere of a chain of gas stations. I think it was in New Jersey or it was definitely in the Northeast. And they were trying to figure out what they were going to do to try to like separate. They were trying to go through like this restructure. And they realized that what they needed to do is pour a bunch of money into the bathrooms and have super clean bathrooms, like cleaner than a, you know, a doctor's office bathroom. And they, that's what they would advertise. And those were the thing, you know, like they had, you know, like they say, the man is the head, but the wife is the neck and the neck turns the head. So the neck would be looking, the wife would see that and say, okay, I want to stop there. And they ended up totally outperforming like multiples, higher margins, and were able to sell obviously a lot more gas and a lot more concessions because they were able to find that thing that actually mattered, which, you know, on the surface, to your point, in this commoditized business of sort of gas stations, they were able to find this thing on the margin that allowed them to truly separate. And it's kind of an example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's actually a good one. That's a good one, though. My very gender neutral kids would not use your example, but they but this is actually a good case because women by and large are much more particular about the restrooms, and that can drive where the whole family goes. I'm married to a woman and I have a daughter who's now a woman too, and when she was a girl, my wife would always be trying to get us to stop, and she'd say, oh, honey, they have very nice restrooms here. Whether it was true or not, just that's how she would sell the fact that we needed to take a bathroom break. Right.
That kind of thing, you know, that kind of a thing. But to hit that nail on the head in a commoditized business, and I think you kind of said it right. Sometimes folks kind of rest on the laurels of their business where maybe there's some sort of outsized margins because it hasn't been commoditized yet, or because, like you said, they have this location, but the greatness of a location can quickly change if, to your example, another gas station pops up across the street.
Exactly.
So what kind of sort of advice would you give to a company that, you know, maybe hasn't been commoditized yet, who's having a trouble sort of seeing the value and kind of spending that extra money to do that differentiation on the border?
I would say it's not extra money. Just, you know, I would say, come on, guys, look at what you're spending on marketing and advertising. You know, having the right number of people well-hired and well-trained answering your phones or answering your emails or answering your texts, it's really a bargain. The most realistic figure I've seen lately is 97% for number of customers who purchase based on word of mouth, 97%. So first I thought, wow, that's a lot. And then I thought, no, I'm sorry, it's 93%. So then I thought, wow, that's a lot. And then I thought, yeah, but who are the 7%? Nick, do you know anyone who doesn't? And I thought, well, yeah, you know what? There must be a couple. And I think the only one I can think of is my uncle. My uncle will read consumers' reports. And otherwise, he's going to make up his decision on his own. He doesn't want to hear from anyone else. So that's it. But if you want the other 93...
Sounds like one of the world's great skeptics.
Yeah, he's awesome. I love him. But if you want the other 93%, then you have to be getting this stuff right. The other thing I tell them is that don't believe that your sales and your marketing can provide you with an endless stream of customers. The way to think about this is that every customer is irreplaceable. If they're gone, they're not coming back. And that's not something you want to have happen.
That's an interesting That's an interesting thing to say, that every customer is irreplaceable or unreplaceable because once they're gone, they are gone.
Yeah. And these days they'll probably take their whole family with them and their friends on online as well.
Yeah. And I feel like in today's economy, so to speak, maybe we rely so much on word of mouth because we're looking for some like authentic, we're looking for some like authentic recommendations to kind of counterbalance the, you know, how inundated we are with just kind of slick looking marketing and just, you know, there's ads just everywhere bombarding us. So we have sort of built up this sort of guard against it. And that word of mouth from your friend or from a colleague that you trust just naturally carries a lot more weight.
Yeah, so traditional marketing is still very valuable. I wouldn't cut your budget on that. But you got to remember that if your customer experience doesn't live up to what your marketing is promising, it will be taken ironically, which is not what you're looking for.
That's a great point. Where have you seen that? You don't have to name names, but what's an example where you've seen that in your, you know, in your experience? We're talking about a company.
Well, sure. Companies that say, oh, we have the best customer service, and they don't. Companies that say their cars are reliable, but they aren't. And on.
Let's talk about the talent management and the recruitment piece, because I think there was really some really interesting pieces in there. And I think sometimes, you know, A lot of the clients that we deal with on a day-to-day basis, you know, they're treated sometimes as this cost center in their organization. But to your point, in this chapter three, for example, they really can play an active role in the value creation of the organization, not just by pushing paper and, you know, hiring people, but helping to screen and helping to foster the type of individuals that are going to be super successful in executing the strategy that we're talking about, which is, you know, creating phenomenal service for the clients to where they're going to be, you know, screaming from the rooftops, what an amazing organization you are. So let's just talk about perhaps some of the big takeaways from that chapter and from the talent management piece and the recruitment piece.
So I'm not a professional HR person, and I don't know from compliance. So Nick, you're going to have to keep me out of legal murky waters here. Okay.
Yes.
But my principles are certainly you need technical skills for many positions, but if it's a customer facing position, you also want to strive to hire for the traits that will give you a better likelihood that the employee will be good with people. And I have five of them, and you'll never forget them if I teach them to everyone in a really silly way. So Nick and everyone else out there, don't close your eyes if you're behind the wheel, but visualize a big wet dog. Okay. Now, is the dog dry or is it wet?
Wet.
All right. And what breed is it? Okay, psych. You can decide that on your own. But it's a big wet dog. And I'm putting it outside the superstore Petco. So this will work because it spells Wetco. So the wet dog is outside Petco. Now, this is really just a rule of, I shouldn't say of thumb, a rule of five fingers. This doesn't replace all the science on the subject, but it's a good way to start thinking about this. An ideal customer-facing employee will have the W, which is warmth. That's just liking other people. The E, which is empathy. That is sensing what someone else is saying before they say it. T, which is teamwork. So some of us are very good with customers, but then we make a promise and we're not willing to work with our team to make the promise come true. So you need to have the teamwork. C is conscientiousness. This just means detail orientedness. And O is optimism, specifically what's called by the psychologist Martin Seligman. He calls this an optimistic explanatory style. So if you have a pessimistic explanatory style, a customer bites your head off and you'll be like, oh, that's terrible. I must have done a horrible thing. I'm going to call in sick and never come back to work. Or if you have an optimistic explanatory style, you might feel bad for a moment and you might think to yourself, well, let me talk to my manager about whether I could have done better. But really, I think that customer is having a bad day. I'm going to dust myself off and take the next call. So at Wetco,
not let that sort of define them as who they are. Not, you know, I guess there's a fine line, right, between sort of sympathizing to the point where you internalize that and sort of let that affect your identity, which is what you're talking about in a certain sense, where somebody can't dust themselves off, but somebody who's more on this optimistic or on this optimism side of the spectrum, they're gonna be able to sort of rise back up and let that warmth shine back out and let that empathy shine back out for that next caller.
Right. It's called an optimistic explanatory style. Absolutely. That's right.
I think you really nailed this this millennials thing. And this was another thing that I thought you really got right and that separated your book from a lot of these other ones that I've read. Millennials are currently the largest generation in the workforce. And in the next 10 years, they're going to make up 75% of the workforce. And this generation is the largest generation since the baby boomers. And they're just wired so differently from sort of generations that, you know, have come before them. I think you hit the nail on the head. I think it was very smart. I think you talked about this generation properly. And I think it was very prudent of you to like spend so much time incorporating this kind of throughout the book. It was kind of peppered throughout, you know, all these different chapters and principles. Talk to us a little bit about how you've seen companies get this millennial thing wrong and what prompted you to incorporate so much of this throughout the book.
Well, my main points about millennials in the book are about them as customers. However, because I've seen so much garbage written about them as employees, I also put in a section about them as employees. So which one do you want me to start with?
I'd like you to start first with the customers part, but then to circle back to the employees part, because I think the foundational underpinnings are, we're kind of talking about a lot of the same things.
All right. So as customers, so millennials and Gen Z, the thing about them is if you can get things right for them, you will soon be pleasing their older brothers and sisters and their parents and even their grandparents. I have a quote in the book from, or maybe it didn't make it in the book, from Hervé Humler, who is one of the founders of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Micah, if we can get it right for the millennial, we get it right for everyone, because they're asking for this thing." I'm like, "Oh man, he doesn't talk like that. He's a very elegant gentleman, but he'll say, you know, "Mon Dieu," and he's French. "Mon Dieu, I never thought anyone would want that before." But if he gets it right for the millennial, he says 5 minutes later, or maybe 5 days later, an older guest is going to ask for it. So it's never wasted time. So I think that's the most important principle, is strive to get things right for the millennials, but realize that we're all becoming a millennial. I mean, there is an actual group on Facebook called "My Life's Officially Over. My Parents Have Joined Facebook." So, I mean, we all know it's true, right?
We all know it's true. Why do you think that is the case, though? Why do you feel like the generation is just more influential? Do you feel like they're more demanding or more sort of particular? And what is sort of the root of that, you think?
Well, now we're going to bring me to a second point, which is let's don't exaggerate. So, and this falls onto the employee side as well. A millennial mom, the ones I've met, they're way more a mom than they are a millennial, right? A millennial runner is more a runner than they are a millennial. Mm-hmm. So let's don't exaggerate. Number two, there are certainly exceptions. I mean, I know Steve Wozniak, and he's not even one of the youngest boomers, but he knows this technology better than, you know, Nick, you and your cohort probably ever will. So there are people of all ages who have different skills, and we shouldn't. I'm looking at Nick, and he seems rather on the youthful side. So I'm just making this assumption.
You're very charming, Micah. You're very charming.
I'm just making this assumption that Steve Wozniak could, debug something faster than you could.
100%.
So we don't want to overgeneralize, and especially with employees. Number one, it's absolutely illegal to overgeneralize. I saw someone sent me the other day, and this is absolutely true. I think it was yesterday. It really pissed me off. If you're out there, thank you for apologizing. He did apologize. But he said, "Hey, I'm looking for a COO for this company, and the ideal candidate will be in his late 20s. And I was like, I'm not going to help you with that one. So,
that's very tone deaf at this point, is it not?
Yeah.
And this is coming from the guy who was talking about the head and the neck before. So it's very tone deaf.
No. Yeah. And I have, this doesn't get mentioned a lot, but there are two, I think, very important sections in my book on diversity and inclusion. Mm-hmm. And those weren't written by me. And the one that was written by Michael Heider, who's an expert very much on inclusion issues in the boardroom, he's the opposite of this guy looking for the apparently male employee in their late 20s. He says he advises boards when they're looking for someone new on the board, and he'll suggest someone who's in their 30s. And they'll say, no, that's not what we're thinking. We were thinking of a man, probably a white man, but it's not always these days, in their 50s. And he'll be like, well, I think you already got that. I think you've already got that.
Yeah, so we're the same.
Right, so it can go in either direction. I'm sorry, what were we talking about?
No, we were just talking about the millennial piece as employees.
Okay, so as employees, I do have a section on this in the book. And the things I want to say are, number one, I mean, I don't say this outright, but all these horrible people saying that millennials all want this prize for doing nothing and all that, you know, come on. The right. only people who say that do not have millennials as kids. If you have millennials as kids and you're saying that, you know what? That's on you, because this is, and I have one. So this is on us. This is how we raise them. We raise them very collaboratively. And I mean, obviously there's exceptions. There's people that kept their kids in cages, right? So there are exceptions, but I think it's a great thing. I think people should have prizes just for showing up. I mean, that's a big deal to show up for work at times. And it's, you know, and
that's a good point.
So I don't beat up on millennials, but then I do say, you know, there are things that this generation is known for. And I suggest, and I'm going to use a term which I find myself using all the time, even though it's jargon, I think you might as well lean into this stuff. You might as well embrace it rather than fight against it. So one of them is that millennials are famous for wanting responsibility right away. I mean, these are the kids, but the thing is, they know a lot. So these are the kids who will walk into the CEO's office and say, on their first day of work, and say, hello, Mr. and Ms. CEO. It's nice to meet you. Why are you still using this spreadsheet? Don't you know all these things, tools are available on the cloud? So if you're Mr. and Ms. CEO, you can say, get out of here. Go back to the mailroom. You know, no, I don't want to hear from you for 4 years, right?
How dare you speak to me and meet my eyes, right?
Exactly, right. Meet your eyes, right? Don't make eye contact. So that's one thing you can do. Or you can think, well, you know what? This person kind of reminds me of my kid, and that's what my kid would say to me. And you know what? 9 times out of 10, at least when it comes to technology, my kid's been right. So let me listen. Let me listen. So number one, listen to them. But number two, this thing about they want to advance really quickly. So they might think they should get a directorship in a couple months. Obviously, I'm exaggerating. But if that's not realistic, we'll find some intermediate ways that they can get more responsibility more quickly. I think there are ways to compromise on these things. So compromise, learn from them, hope that they have things to learn from you as well. I mean, one of the amazing findings of millennials that we forget is that on average, they get along with their parents a lot better than the boomers did, right? It's only on the History Channel now, or you can look at the story called The Gap. That's a riff on the generation gap. That was how boomers couldn't get along with their parents. Well, millennials, by and large, get along with their parents. They often mention them as their best friend. Now, I promise you, when everyone had buttons that said, don't trust anyone over 30, you know, those people you saw at demonstrations and love-ins, they were not best friends with their parents. So by extension, they can also become friends with older people in their workforce.
That's a great point. And I had a conversation with a generational consultant named Lindsay Bacardo last week.
Okay.
Really nails this stuff. I don't know if you know her or not, but I'll introduce you. I think you'll really like her work. She nails it. But she brought up the point that in that baby boomer generation, a lot of those people went to school and that had corporal punishment, and a lot of them were hit so much by parents and those in positions of authority that.
I don't know the baby. I'm going to argue with her on that. The boomer generation was raised on Dr. Spock, so he was not telling people to hit their kids. So
I know not how they were raised. Like there was still, like, when my parents were in school, they were still getting hit in school. So I'm saying that that is not in
wow okay okay
so that's not in place anymore. And like there's less corporal punishment in like today's in the households that millennials are raised in. And I'm just saying when you compare that to two
generations. I should hope so. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I'm saying when you compare that to two generations ago, that helps explain those don't trust anybody over 30 buttons because there was that natural sort of division between them.
Okay.
And what I'm saying, that feeds into what you're talking about because there's that sort of more level playing field between the parents and the children, and the children look at their parents as their best friends and so forth. There's not this fear of authority that the previous generations had, which prevented them from on their first day going into the CEO's office and trying to help and trying to do something to make a difference, which this generation doesn't. And so those who came from that previous generation, when they see that person, that intern from the mailroom saying like, hey, our social media approach stinks, or why are we still doing this thing? They take offense to it, to your point. Not because, you know, it's like, why do you, you know, you are so out of line to even think you could talk to me in this authority like that, where I'm just saying that it's so much more on a level playing field and egalitarian and so forth from this generation's perspective that causes them to raise their hand when, you know, previous generations, they never would. So to your point, I think it's a massive opportunity to get better input. And if you look at feedback as an actual gift, you have eyes that are sort of closer to the edge of, you know, the bleeding edge or the cutting edge of, you know, where the culture is and so forth, that you can then begin to integrate into your strategy or to whatever you're doing.
Absolutely. It's just a little footnote in the book, but I remember when my daughter was in the back seat of the car, and she'd been raised, I mean, she's only two or something. She's been raised on all this collaborative language. And so my wife and I and my mother-in-law were trying to decide which white tablecloth restaurant to go to or what boutique restaurant. And we're choosing between two. And my daughter pipes up from the back seat and she says, I think we should all wait, her voice was much higher back then. I think we should compromise and go to McDonald's. Of course we did.
Difference. Yeah. Well, no white tablecloths. Okay? But again, many in our generation, you know, I'm a millennial myself, like we weren't told you're supposed to be seen and not heard. And that was what baby boomers were definitely told. And that's what they sort of pushed out. And that's what kind of drives a lot of those kind of experiences and structures that are still imposed on these organizations. So I think you know, I loved all the diversity and inclusivity touch points that you had throughout. What made you incorporate, again, this is like such a contemporary book, even without all that stuff, without the millennial stuff and without that diversity stuff, I think you really hit this book out of the park. But those extra elements and those extra dimension, you know, that extra dimensionality that you brought to the table made it not only so much more relevant, but so much more actionable. What was sort of the root of you bringing that into the mix?
Well, it's important. And I would find in my sections on HR, I would kind of get right close to these subjects, but maybe not go 100% on it. So I wanted to get two experts. And one of the experts is Jeanne Jones Blackhurst. She was the two-time female mayor of what at least at the time was the most misogynist city in America, Las Vegas.
Right.
I like to think Jeanne and people like her have changed it. But so she was one of them. And then Michael Heider is this amazing African-American gentleman who actually I've known a long time, and I thought he could speak on it very, very well.
But what prompted you to bring that into the mix? Is it just the sort of—
Well, I think it's important. I think it's extremely important. And I just hate seeing people disregard this stuff. I mean, the guy yesterday who gave me the pitch about the COO he was looking for, who should be in his late 20s. It's just, I mean, you're leaving so much talent out there on the table, kind of a weird metaphor, but you're leaving all that talent on the table and you're disregarding people. I mean, I wrote this article the other day. It's one of my most popular articles on Forbes, where I write a lot of articles, but it's on, it's called "My Boss Wants Me to Only Hire Good Looking Front Desk People" or something like that. It's about the people I hear who think that someone who works at the front desk of a hotel or a retail establishment should look a particular way. And I push back against that in the article.
Yeah, and also
ironically, I like to think that the reason that people read the article is because it was an interesting title. But I did have a very attractive person, not really on purpose, but I had the stock photo model in the article is actually very attractive. So yeah, that could, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, that's funny. But when I look back at Wetco, there's not looks or anything in there.
No,
it's really more about the warmth and the feeling that somebody gets when you meet somebody at the front desk than a cold, sort of good-looking person. I mean, it's such a backwards way of thinking that, again, it still seems to be kind of infiltrating a lot of businesses. Why do you think so many organizations, I mean, so I kind of have this theory where, you know, there's this hard and soft in business or really in life, right? Uh-huh. The hard is the objective. It's the numbers. It's the, you know, the frameworks, the stuff you learn in MBA school. And the soft is like, you know, is the personality or the culture or some, a lot of the stuff that your book covers. Mm. And my theory is that the hard stuff is easy. You can read that stuff in a book. You can learn that in a lecture, but the soft stuff is what's hard. Why do you think it's so hard for people to like get the ethos of what you're talking about here? Because your book is really about one thing and you talk about it from many different facets and many different angles, but why is it so tough for some types to like get this ethos and digest it and like see the opportunity in it?
Well, I don't want to come off as a, can we say schmuck on this? I don't want to come off as a schmuck, but as Nick said first, there is a lot of stuff written on the subject that is hard to digest, or it is just really off point. And
right.
So it's not always taught well. I mean, I've written 5 books and I think they're all good, but I feel like each one has improved in how it gets these things across. And I do think it helps to get it across in a few different ways, as you said, anecdotally and so forth, different ways to get at it. But I think it's like there's a late, great, fantastic, inspirational speaker. And I don't think of myself as an inspirational speaker, though I hope I'm not.
Oh, come on.
Demotivational speaker. But a very inspirational speaker, Zig Ziglar, he would say, you know, you do have to work on these things every day. He said, you know, I can't say I bathed, you know, last month, and so I don't have to.
I love him. He's one of my all-time favorites. And he says, you know, motivation is like bathing.
Okay, that's the quote. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's that thing. You have to keep doing it. And it's not a set it and forget it. It's not like you say, okay, our customer service project is done. You know, let's move on to something else. You have to say, okay, I'm going to continue to engage in this customer service thing forever. And this is going to be sort of who we are and what we are and so forth. I think you...
Right. And so that's exactly right. So the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company, which has the highest levels of customer service of most any institution in any industry. And of course, they have very worthy competitors in 5-star hotels, but they're one of the best. And how have they grown while not losing their edge? Well, in 1983, they started having what they call daily lineups. And it's only 10 minutes because more than 10 minutes becomes a meeting and nobody needs an extra meeting in their day. But it happens every day. If the hotel runs more than one shift, which, you know, by and large they do, then it's the beginning of every shift. And at every level of the organization, they discuss the same point on each day of their service standards. So it rotates. It doesn't have to be run by a manager. It can be run by a frontline employee who is studied up and talked about. And they don't talk about revenue and so forth. They only talk about what you're calling the soft skills. And so, I mean, they do it when it's raining. They do it when it's sunny. They do it when there's been an earthquake. They do it when there are fears right now of coronavirus really affecting the travel industry. They do it every single day. And they don't just do it at the frontline level. They do it in the executive suite as well. So does your company have that kind of commitment? Most of us don't. Mm-hmm. But if you want to always be improving, that's how you do it.
Yeah. And that also does something else, right? That not only sort of rises to the front of everyone's mind or the forefront of everyone's mind, what's important, because, hey, we're talking about this quote unquote soft stuff every day. It also, I think, kind of gives everyone a voice to show different examples of how this stuff manifests and kind of creates this sort of, hey, we're all in this together type of a culture, and gives, you know, again, a voice for people to speak up and share their own experiences. And those things begin to sort of build a tapestry, so to speak, of, you know, a high thread count, you know, tapestry of all these different experiences.
Awesome. You know what I mean? Awesome. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a really nice analogy. I mean, there's a sheet and then there's a sheet, and
right. So, I loved this chapter where you talked about like story and create experiences that can be great stories. You know, the power of wow and creating stories that customers will remember and spread. This is chapter 4.
Right.
Why do you think story has such an impact on us as people? And maybe give us some examples of some stuff from that chapter, or just kind of this broad concept, because I really love this chapter and it really resonated with me. And I think our listeners are going to love some of the takeaways from here.
So this is a chapter on wow customer service. So the reason that you want to create wow is because most of us think in terms of stories, and it's a very good way to, as we were talking before, of keeping your brand out of the commodity zone. If you can have something that is memorable, that goes out of the ordinary, and that your customer talks about it, that's a great way for them to spread the word. Now, I do something in the book which almost no other authors admit, which is that it's not always the right time for wow. If you go into a retail store and they're like, "How's your day going?" and blah blah blah, and wow, nice haircut, Nick, and you're like not in the mood, then the story you're going to tell is, "Wow, I really couldn't get in and out of that store really quickly." So
yeah, read the room.
Right. Exactly. Read the room. I like that very well. I would also say there's two kinds of wow. The wow that we hear about in books like mine is almost exclusively these really over the top wow examples. And I have some of those, and I think those are great. They're really powerful. But there's also what I talk about in the book, what I call everyday wow. Mm-hmm. So everyday wow, the example in the book is that I'm in the contact center at Zappos, and they call the contact center the customer loyalty team. So Madison is a member of the customer loyalty team, and she's on the phone with an older, and I'm saying older because it's relevant in this case. She's like a grandma, and she's frustrated because she wants to go to, I think it was her daughter's wedding. Well, I have to look it up in the book. It's her daughter or her niece's wedding. And she's ordered some narrow shoes from Zappos, but they're uncomfortable. And so she's really frustrated because the wedding's coming up really soon. So instead of Madison immediately saying, well, I can facilitate an exchange for that for you, miss. Instead, she says, honestly, narrows are the worst. My aunt has narrow feet. And I swear, at least every other phone call I have with my aunt, we talk about how miserable she is with her feet. It's like the whole shoe industry has conspired against you nice people with the narrow feet. So then, of course, across generations, they are best friends immediately. And then Madison and the now calmed down, really charmed woman on the other end of the line can get down to business, and they can kind of browse together and find some shoes that both will look a little bit classy, which the customer wanted, and probably won't be a torture fest when the wedding happens. So that's what I call a moment of everyday wow. And even that one's a little more elaborate than most of them at Zappos. Mostly it's like they hear a dog barking at the other end of the line. They're like, "Oh, what kind of dog do you have?" And they're like, "Yeah, oh, I love whatever it is. I love Labradoodles." Or the kids are crying. They're not like, "Could you mute that kid for a moment?" They're like, So these are all moments for everyday wow. And it really makes a difference. Now, how does it make a difference? Well, Zappos is an e-commerce company. So well over 95% of the sales are made online. Almost nobody calls in to make a sale. However, they do theorize, and the number's probably lower now, but they do theorize that every Zappos customer is going to call one time in their lifetime as a customer. That's their theory. So when they do call that one time, and it's usually because they're very frustrated.
Right.
If we can just really make a connection then every time we are online with that customer, they will sense the engagement. And this theory works in other industries as well. Why do banks still have branches? You might wonder, why the heck do banks still have branches? Well, they have branches because studies show that if you meet quote unquote your person at a bank or a financial services company, if you meet them once, then every time you interact with them electronically after that, whoever them really is, you feel like you put a face to the name and you feel more comfortable.
Interesting. Yeah, so it's kind of an investment in the peace of mind, really, that they're trying to provide in the context of people entrusting them with their life savings or their treasure or whatever.
Exactly.
This is kind of the antithesis of what you were talking about, the kind of everyday wow, the story okay. that you talked about with the woman who lost her wedding ring.
Right. Oh, my goodness.
I just like, I kind of got chills reading that excerpt. That was really, really a phenomenal. I mean, what an amazing thing that they did to do that. Tell us that story. And then...
So this one is so astounding, and I guess the stars aligned on this, but the fact that they even tried is amazing. So there's this fantastically luxurious cruise line called Seabourn Cruise Line, and it's these are truly five-star hotels, but on the open seas, which, as you can imagine, is not easy to pull off because they have different vending issues and so forth, but it's a remarkable ships, and they have an actual Thomas Keller restaurant on board, and they're quite amazing. But it's not so much the food, and it's not so much the marble, and it's not so much these touches. It's also how they interact with their guests, and they do call their passengers guests. So in this case, a couple are getting ready to go on an offshore, disembarking? They're going to disembark.
Yeah.
I could never get that right.
They get off the boat. I sound like
they get off the boat for a short cruise. Talking about. Right? Right. They get off the boat for a shore tour. And on the way out, the woman is applying hand lotion, and they're like on the ramp and she's still applying hand lotion because she doesn't want to miss her tour. And her wedding ring falls off the ship into the water. So I said to the president of Seabourn, I said, well, that sounds pretty final.
He right.
said, yeah, it looks pretty final. So she's distraught. She's miserable. They tell her, go on your off the boat adventure, and we'll get everything started for the paperwork for the insurance replacement by the time you come back. So they're like, okay, we'll try to enjoy the day anyway. And they leave. And once they're out of earshot, the captain says to the other people, he's like, well, you know, maybe we'll have to do that insurance, but I've got a better idea. So he noticed that there were some divers in the area, and he asked them if they'd go look for this ring by the boat, which was safe to do, I guess, because it was tied up and everything at that moment. And you can tell I'm not much of a nautical person, but yeah. Apparently it was safe to do at that point. And they had permission to do this, so they weren't going to get harpooned as being pirates, right?
Yeah,
they
right.
had the permission to do this. And they found the ring. And so when the couple comes back, they go to their room, and they get this call saying the captain wanted to see you for a moment. And he hands them like this paper bag. I think it really, the whole shtick, he hands them this paper bag. Inside the bag, there's a little box. And inside the box, there's her wedding ring.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine?
Like, great?
Her day was such a roller coaster. She was
yes.
so excited to get to disembark or get off the boat or whatever we call it. She, you know, the entire day, I'm sure her spouse was trying to, you know, cheer her up and say, you know, it's okay. The insurance is going to take care of it. But there is a certain sentimentality to those things. Even if you get the exact same ring, you know what I'm saying? It's like, it's yeah. not the same ring. It's not the same atoms configured in that same loop and right. doesn't have those same memories. So just to get that back, it's such a, you know, again, that's on the other end of the spectrum of the everyday wow, but it was just such right. a powerful story that, again, if that organization, I forget the cruise line name.
Seabourn Cruise Line.
Seabourn. Like if that, whoever made that decision to go and ask those people diving, if they weren't empowered with the ethos of that organization to put those guests first, not the customer, the guest first, that would have never even happened. But there's so many companies where there's people who are well-intending, who are on those front lines that have those opportunities, but they don't think that they're allowed to. And I think you talked
about,
I think it was like the Carlton where you were talking about the family who was going to Hong Kong and they had the food allergies and so forth. And these guys just went above and beyond, and they weren't nickel and diming and figuring out, okay, is how many hours are we allocating toward, you know, this person spending time trying to find the right, you know, peanut free restaurants for this family to enjoy their trip. They were just unleashed to do the big thing. And the big thing was to provide a phenomenal experience for that client or for that guest or whatever they call them in that case. Mm-hmm. But it takes, to me, it just takes this sort of next level of thinking that a lot of organizations refuse to get at. And I don't know if it's a personality type thing. I don't know if it's a generational thing. I don't know if it's a money over everything type of a thing, but it prevents them from being able to sort of unleash their people. It's kind of a fear, right? They don't want them to like waste time or waste money or whatever. What do you think that is? Do you think that those light bulbs are able to ever be turned on at the top, so to speak? Or do you think it's just a function of that sort of type that they're just going to be immovable and they're never going to see the value of these indirect functions that are able to sort of influence the whole on an exponential or disproportionate basis?
Well, it's a whole program that you have to do, and you can come up with it organically, or you can, and again, I'm not trying to be schmucky about this. It's all in the book. I promise you,
let me get this out of the way. This book should be required reading. You know, I think that we're all in sales, and to the extent that we're all servants in our organizations, whether you're with a client or not, there's so much that you can gather from this book and the types of experiences that you're creating for your internal or external clients. So I'll be schmucky about it and I'll say it because this was one of the best books I read this year, but I'm sorry, go ahead. You're saying organic or
it's
not?
It's all in there. It's all in there. And I didn't make this stuff up, but you know, you need to define your purpose and you need to do it in very few words so it doesn't become this long thing that nobody can remember. Then you need to figure out how to live it. And the first way to live it, the first thing you might want to change is that you're going to change your hiring practices. But you're not going to get rid of all the people you already have. You're going to convince them over time that you really believe in your purpose. So like the Mayo Clinic in healthcare, their purpose is the needs of the patient come first. Not all the patients, not some amorphous bunch of patients, but the patient is right in front of you. But then what does that mean? It means you can interrupt your work to help a patient who really needs it. Even if you're housekeeping, if you're quote unquote just housekeeping, if you see a patient or their mom or their kid who's apparently upset about how the treatment is going, you're not going to redo the surgery, but you can talk to them and say, absolutely, I'll get you to a nurse or someone who can talk to you about how things are going. So over time, you are going to convince your existing employees that you mean it, that the needs of the customer really do come first, the needs of the patient come first. You also have to convince your employees that they are empowered, because since people have been reading stuff that I write and coming to my speeches and stuff, and they're all saying empowered, but empowered is like sprinkled on top of a sundae of crap, right? I mean, and it doesn't mean anything. There was this you can look this up in the New York Times. There is this story about one of the major banks, and it says in their mission statement, you are empowered to do what's right. That's what it says.
Powerful, if that's true.
Right. But the article is about how one of them in their contact center talks to a customer of the bank who didn't, it was like Christmas, I mean, unbelievably melodramatic story. Christmas Eve, he didn't have money for gas and he was stuck at the gas station and he needed to get home to give his kids their presents. I mean, a horrible story. When her shift was over, she went there with like $10 of her own money, gave it to him. It turned out this guy was for real. He gassed up his car. He thanked her. She got fired.
Yeah, I heard that story, and I get chills when I hear it. Like, I just got chills when you just said it.
This is why they don't believe us when we say empowered, because their last boss was this flaming jerk, and empowerment just means you are empowered to take a risk and get fired for it. So what the Ritz-Carlton says differently is they say, it's your job to be empowered. It's your job to create these amazing moments for customers, and sometimes they're solving a problem, and sometimes they're creating a happy moment from scratch. It could be either way, but you are empowered to do this, and it's your job to be empowered. It's your job to make these legendary moments happen.
Yeah, so it's not just like you said, it's not a side dish or a piece of parsley on the plate. It is
Your analogy is much nicer than mine.
But so as you can tell, I kind of nerd out on this stuff, but I don't believe that the person who wrote at this bank that you're talking about, who wrote, our employees are empowered to do the right thing. I don't believe this is, you know, this might be my bright-eyed, bushy-tailed view of the world. I don't believe that they wrote that in sort of a subversive way to just, hey, this kind of sounds good. I believe the person who typed that on the page actually wanted them, their employees to be able to do the right thing.
Oh yeah.
But as that trickled down to this call center and this boss and something broke down along the way where there was a disconnect between what was right and what wasn't right and what was over a line, and then somebody got fired for it. And yet you see an organization like the Ritz-Carlton, which that breakdown doesn't seem to happen. So what is the sort of the systemic difference between these two types of organizations where there's someone well-meaning at the top over here and there's someone well-meaning at the top over here, but there's a breakdown on one side and that ends up kind of being able to sort of flow freely down on the other side. What do you think that is?
Well, I have no idea how that happened. When this was finally brought to the CEO's attention, he seemed quite chastened, but it was really hard to get his attention, as opposed to a much more fun example and not really as, you know, not as much at stake in this one. But there's an example in my book. This is some years ago, and this gentleman in first class on Virgin Atlantic, and they are so adorable, these Brits. They call it upper class, which I think is hilarious. So he's in, isn't that, I love that. Isn't that
it's
funny?
Amazing.
So he's in upper class. He's in upper class, and he's flying from, I guess, London to Mumbai, and he does this a lot. This guy knows his stuff, and he really knows food. So he writes this letter to Sir Richard Branson, describing in detail how horrible the quote unquote Indian food was in upper class. And it's so funny. It's just one of the funniest letters ever. So the people at Virgin didn't do, I think, what happened at this bank. They didn't take this letter and hide it from Richard. They got it to his attention, and he saw this, and he falls on the floor laughing. That's his number one response. His number two response is he calls the guy, and they become friendly a little bit. And his number three response is he puts him on the culinary advisory board for Virgin Atlantic.
Amazing.
So now he has, and I don't know why I'm being so profane on your podcast, but now he has this guy pissing out instead of pissing in, right?
bring him into the fold.
Exactly.
That's amazing. Well, this has been a great conversation.
Oh my God, it's been great.
Where can people find you? Obviously the book, Ignore Your Customers and They'll Go Away by Micah Solomon. I'll post some links to the book. They can get it on Amazon or whatever. But
where is your local bookseller if you still have one?
Yeah, if you can still find one. Where else can people find you? Where can they get more of your work? You have really just a unique, fresh voice. I'd love, you know, plug your other books. Tell us what those other topics are, where they can find you, where some of your other articles and writings are, because you're a great person to follow and learn from.
Well, thank you so much, Nick. So if I could plug for a second my services as well. If you think your customer service is pretty good, then I can come in and help you make it better. And if you think your service is terrible, if you contact me, the odds seem to be good that it's not that bad, but we'll find out just how not that bad it is, and then we'll work from there. So that's what I do. I'm a customer service turnaround expert. However, if you are the diehard DIY, do-it-yourself person, as I've confessed, it's all in the book. So it really is in the book, which is Ignore Your Customers and They'll Go Away. There's two ways to find me. One involves being really good at spelling biblical names, and I'm sorry, but this is the name I have. So if you can spell it, you'll get to me. That's my website is micahsolomon.com, MICAHSOLOMON. There's no A in Solomon.com. Again, that's MICAHSOLOMON.com. So not very easy. Or, and this is I love this. This is the mischievous side of my personality coming out. You can find my book, and there's three free chapters. Just go to the URL, ignorethisbook.com.
Love it. And what's the name of your organization? Would they come to micahsolomon.com to
consulting
services and stuff?
Yeah, exactly. Micah Solomon and Associates.
Very good. Well, listen, I just appreciate your time. I appreciate how forthcoming you are.
I appreciate yours.
in this book and this conversation. I feel like I learned a lot. It was great to finally connect with you. I've been following you for a while now, especially after I read this. And just thank you so much for your time.
Oh, no. Thank you for yours. I really appreciate it.
I love the callback. Have a great day.
Thanks, Nick.